We would like to send out a special thanks to Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. You can download it free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Thank you, and enjoy the show. August 18th, 1987. Manatee County, Florida. Todd McAfee, the 27-year-old manager of a tomato farm, is discovered to be missing from his trailer after his employees arrive for work. Todd's body is soon discovered in a drainage ditch, and he has been shot 4 times. Since a valuable gun collection was stolen from Todd's trailer, he was apparently killed during a burglary, and police investigate a sighting of some suspects who were seen in the area in an orange van on the day of the crime. Years later, Todd's former housekeeper is indicted for his murder, but the charges are dropped when the case against her falls apart, and the crime continues to remain unsolved. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to tackle a cold case which was featured on one of the rarest segments of Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 murder of Todd McAfee. Todd ran a tomato farm in rural Florida before he was shot to death during an apparent burglary of his trailer. Todd's former housekeeper was eventually charged with his murder after she allegedly confessed her involvement in the crime to a jailhouse informant, but the charges would be dropped after the informant recanted his story. The case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in September of 1989, but as far as I can tell, the segment only aired on television once, though this may have been due to logistical reasons, not because there was anything wrong with the segment. During the summer season, Unsolved Mysteries would occasionally film brand new segments to insert into their reruns, and that's exactly what happened with the Todd McAfee case, as it aired during an episode featuring segments which had already aired before. The only problem is that some of these exclusive rerun segments were almost completely forgotten about and rarely, if ever, aired again. The McAfee segment is currently not available for viewing on Amazon Prime, and it would be decades before I actually saw it. But over the past year, the segment has been uploaded to YouTube, so I thought I would cover it on the podcast, since it's a pretty intriguing case, which is still unsolved to this day. Anyway, once I'm done discussing Todd's murder, I'm also going to take an opportunity to talk about another cold case from Florida, which I consider to be one of the most baffling stories ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries. It involves a young man named Tim Molnar, who went missing from his hometown of Daytona Beach before his remains were discovered over 1,200 miles away in rural Wisconsin. Unfortunately, there's very little information available out there about this case, but it's so bizarre that I've been itching to talk about it for a long time and will do so near the end of this episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by discussing the unsolved murder of Todd McAfee. Our story begins in Florida in 1987. Our central figure is 27-year-old Todd McAfee, who lives in a rural area of Manatee County, which is so isolated that his closest neighbor is 4 miles away. Before moving to Florida, Todd grew up in a farming family, graduated from Louisiana Tech University with a degree in agribusiness. He was hoping to pursue a successful career in corporate agriculture, and during the summer of 1986, he got a job managing a tomato farm for the Bonita Packing Company, which involved supervising a crew of laborers. The 100-acre farm was located off State Road 70, and Todd lived and worked inside a company trailer on the property. At around 6:30 a.m. on the morning of August the 18th, the farm's laborers showed up for work, but were surprised to find that Todd had not unlocked the front gate for them, so they had to wait for their foreman, Adam Williams, to arrive and let them in. When they entered the property, Adam noticed that Todd's truck was parked in front of his car near the trailer, even though it was standard practice for him to normally park it behind his car. Adam decided to check inside Todd's trailer, and there was no sign of him, though the trailer appeared to have been ransacked, and there were 2 empty handgun cases also lying on the floor. Todd also noticed that the spindles in Todd's answering machine were still spinning, but the machine's tape was missing. One of the laborers decided to check inside Todd's pickup truck and noticed that the keys were still in the ignition. A bag of groceries Todd had purchased, as well as a videotape he had rented from a convenience store in nearby Mayaca City the previous day, were resting on the front seat. An empty case where Todd ordinarily kept one of his guns was on the dashboard, though the gun itself was missing. But most disturbingly, there was a large quantity of blood in the bed of the pickup truck, and Todd's blood-covered glasses were lying there as well. At around 10 a.m., some of the laborers were forced to pull over at a spot 2 miles from the farm because their truck had overheated. While searching for water, they wound up coming across Todd's body in a drainage ditch. The Manatee County Sheriff's Office were soon summoned to the scene and discovered that Todd had been shot 4 times with .22-caliber hollow-point bullets. Spatters of blood were found in some sand, which suggested that Todd's body had been placed on the ground before he was dumped in the ditch. A series of footprints were also found at the scene, and given that Todd was 6'5" and weighed 215 pounds, it was suspected that more than one person would have been required to carry his body. Investigators theorized that the reason Todd's body was dumped at that particular location was because a 15-foot alligator was known for inhabiting the drainage ditch, so his killers may have hoped that the gator would consume his body and destroy potential evidence. All of Todd's employees from the tomato farm were interrogated, and police even videotaped the soles from all their shoes, but none of them seemed to match the footprints from the crime scene. When investigators performed a thorough search of Todd's trailer, they came up with a likely motive for his murder. Todd was known for being an avid gun collector who loved hunting and was a member of the local gun club. He also spent a lot of time target shooting on his property, and it was no big secret throughout the area that he kept a fairly valuable gun collection inside his trailer. In fact, the previous October, some of Todd's guns had been stolen when his trailer was burglarized. His entire gun collection was now missing, as well as a VCR and some cameras. Judging by the receipt from the grocery bag inside Todd's truck, it was estimated that he had returned to his trailer sometime between 6:30 and 7 p.m. on the evening of August the 17th, and was likely ambushed and shot to death when he caught the perpetrators in the act of committing a burglary. Todd may have grabbed the missing gun he normally kept inside the empty case on his truck's dashboard, but he was shot before he had the chance to use it. The perpetrators then used the truck to transport Todd's body to the drainage ditch before driving it back. The tire tracks in the sand seem to indicate that Todd's truck had sped up to the trailer after he drove through the front gate, possibly because he noticed a suspicious vehicle there. Indeed, 2 of Todd's friends would tell investigators that at around 6:15 that same evening, they were driving down the road past Todd's trailer and noticed an orange van parked outside. Well, the description of the orange van would soon lead to an interesting eyewitness sighting. Sometime on the afternoon of August the 17th, a customer was getting gas at a service station in Mayaca City, located about 7 miles from Todd's property, and a 1970s model orange van was parked next to her. The customer noticed a blonde woman standing outside the van, who appeared to be in her mid to late 20s, and was wearing a gold necklace with the initials RB. The customer decided to strike up a conversation with the woman, but suspected she may have been under the influence of drugs. While this was going on, the van's driver's side door was still open, and the customer noticed what appeared to be an automatic weapon in the front seat. It wasn't long before a man who appeared to be in his 30s and had a tattoo of an eagle on his left arm exited the gas station's convenience store and slammed the van door shut. He became angry when he saw that his female companion was having a conversation and struck her repeatedly while yelling, "What are you trying to do? Get us in trouble?" The customer overheard the woman refer to the man as Rob before he forced her inside the van. A second man exited the store, while the first man yelled what sounded like, "Get in the van, runt," before he climbed inside as well, and the van drove away. The customer would later be placed under hypnosis, so she could provide more detailed descriptions of the two men, the woman, and the van. Unfortunately, the investigation into Todd's murder would come to a temporary halt when a Florida Highway Patrol trooper named Jeffrey Young was shot to death during a routine traffic stop on the very same day Todd's body was found. As a result, deputies from the Manatee County Sheriff's Office were diverted from this case to assist in the manhunt for Young's killer before he was captured. Regardless, when the investigation resumed, Todd's family would offer a $5,000 reward for information leading to an arrest, and the case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in September of 1989. Just over 4 years later, the Manatee County Sheriff would form the Investigative Criminal Enforcement Unit, in which unpaid volunteers from law enforcement could explore unsolved cold cases in which the investigation had reached a dead end. And it wasn't long before there would be an interesting development in Todd's case. Jacob Wesley Scott, an inmate serving time in a Florida prison for armed robbery, came forward and claimed that 3 years earlier, he had been incarcerated in the DeSoto County Jail with a woman named Ruthie Mae Anderson, who had been arrested on charges of dealing in stolen property. Before his death, Ruthie had worked as Todd McAfee's part-time housekeeper and was hired to clean his trailer once a week, and her husband, Wilbur Anderson, was also an employee at the tomato farm. According to Scott, Ruthie told him that she had organized a burglary of Todd's trailer alongside Wilbur and two other accomplices, but when they broke in, they were taken by surprise when Todd suddenly returned home, so they wound up shooting him to death. At the time of the murder, the Andersons had been living in Arcadia, Florida, but by this point, the couple were separated. Ruthie was living in Mississippi, while Wilbur was serving time in an Alabama prison for armed robbery. Around the same time period, another man was arrested in Arcadia with a .30 caliber Plainfield semi-automatic rifle in his possession. It turned out this was one of the guns which was stolen from Todd's trailer, and the man would claim that it had been sold to him by Wilbur Anderson. Investigators would also locate an orange van in a Mississippi junkyard, which matched the description of the van seen outside Todd's trailer, and while it could not be conclusively proven that the van was used in the crime, the junkyard owner also claimed that Wilbur sold it to him. Based on this new evidence, as well as Jacob Wesley Scott's story, Ruthie Mae Anderson was charged with first-degree murder and arrested in Mississippi in October of 1994. Ruthie was extradited back to Manatee County, where she would be indicted by a grand jury. However, the case against Ruthie wasn't particularly strong, as ballistics tests could not link any of the recovered guns to the murder weapon that shot Todd. The media would publish the descriptions and serial numbers for 5 guns which had been stolen from Todd's trailer and were still missing, but they could not be found or linked to Ruthie. Her trial was scheduled to begin in July of 1995, but Jacob Wesley Scott eventually decided to recant his story. This wound up putting a major dent into the case against Ruthie, so the murder charge was dropped, and she was released from custody and returned to Mississippi. Wilbur Anderson was never charged in relation to this case, and he would be released from prison on the armed robbery charge in 1996. After this, the investigation once again reached a standstill, and there have not been any substantial developments in over 2 decades. A Todd McAfee Memorial Scholarship has since been established at Louisiana Tech University, which is awarded every year to a student who enters the field of agribusiness, but unfortunately, the murder of the individual this scholarship is named after continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. We're going to be closing in on our 200th episode pretty soon, so that obviously means I have quite a passion for true crime. But even the most devoted true crime fans need a break every now and then, which is why Best Fiends is my go-to refresher whenever I need a mental palate cleanser. The good news is that Best Fiends engages my brain the same way creating an episode of this podcast does, as each cold case I feature is a jigsaw puzzle which needs to be put together. Best Fiends is similar in that it contains a story which involves solving challenging puzzles that really engage your brain. One of the best things about it is that it's a casual game anyone can play, and it's even made for adults. You can spend as much or as little time as you'd like in the game. Most of the characters are cute bugs, while the antagonists are not-so-cute slugs. In addition to the challenging and fun puzzles, Best Fiends also has a vibrant and colorful visual design, and because it does not require internet to play, it is great for traveling and a very handy companion during my bus and train commutes to my day job. I've been playing the game for months now, and keep attaining higher levels, but one of Best Fiends' best qualities is that it updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. So engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters too. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. So download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So for the longest time, this particular segment was almost considered to be the holy grail among Unsolved Mysteries fans because it was so hard to find. If you visit the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, you'll see a number of old posts from aficionados who were trying to track down a copy. Like I mentioned earlier, the main reason this segment is so obscure is because it didn't air within a regular episode, as the show put together a new segment during the summer break and inserted it into a rerun which aired in September, alongside segments which had already previously aired. Believe it or not, they actually did the same thing for one of the most memorable segments ever featured on the show, the Mike Reamer Diana Robertson case, which was also originally featured in a rerun that aired the week before the Todd McAfee segment. This might be the reason the Reamer Robertson segment is currently not available for viewing on Amazon Prime or YouTube, as it was never featured as part of a full-fledged new episode, though it was aired a lot during syndication. But the Todd McAfee segment just faded into a complete obscurity, and I never even saw it until it suddenly appeared on YouTube nearly 3 decades later, though it goes without saying that it is not part of FilmRise's official Unsolved Mysteries YouTube channel. And here's one more amusing piece of trivia. You probably know that Unsolved Mysteries often like to air a montage of random clips from their segments during the opening credits of the show. You might notice that during their earlier seasons, they often featured a brief shot of a guy firing an automatic rifle at someone, and for the longest time, I could not figure out where that clip originated from. But when I finally watched the Todd McAfee segment, and one of the reenactments featured that same guy firing an automatic rifle at Todd, it was a major aha moment for me. So it's pretty ironic that the show used a clip from one of their most obscure, rarely aired segments as part of their opening montage. Anyway, now let's start talking about the case itself. The theory investigators had about Todd McAfee's murder is a very logical one. He lived out in a trailer on a remote farm in the middle of nowhere, which would make him an ideal target for a burglary, and it was apparently common knowledge throughout the community that he owned a valuable gun collection. So it would make perfect sense if Todd surprised some burglars when he arrived home, and they wound up shooting him and using his truck to transport his body to the drainage ditch. They then return the truck to the property and use their own vehicle, likely an orange van, to flee the scene. This would explain why Todd's truck was not parked in its usual spot when his employees showed up for work the following morning. By the way, I know it's way too easy to crack jokes at the Sunshine State's expense, but dumping Todd's body in that particular ditch because a 15-foot alligator was known to frequent there is probably the most Florida thing ever. It's probably a stroke of luck that the laborer's truck overheated near that location, because otherwise, the alligator may have destroyed all the evidence before Todd was found. One of the oddest details about this crime is the fact that the tape from Todd's answering machine was stolen. The theory pushed forward by investigators is that the person responsible for the crime may have left a message on the machine shortly before Todd was murdered and decided to get rid of the tape to destroy a recording of their voice. If true, this would lend credence to the idea that Todd knew his killer, and of course years later, his part-time housekeeper, Ruthie Mae Anderson, would be indicted for his murder. So could her voice have been on that tape? If Ruthie often visited Todd's trailer to clean it, then it's reasonable to assume that she would have known what kind of valuables he kept in there and had a pretty good idea of when he would be away from his property so that she could organize a burglary. The theory of Ruthie being the instigator of this crime does make logical sense, but there are still complicating factors here which might explain why they ultimately decided not to take her to trial. As you recall, the biggest lead during the early stages of the investigation was the sighting of two men and a woman in an orange van at a local gas station a short time before an orange van was seen on Todd's property, so it's reasonable to assume those people were involved in the murder. But there's one major problem. The two men and the woman were white, but Ruthie Mae Anderson and her husband Wilbur are black. Of course, you could write off this lead by assuming that the gas station sighting was just a red herring, and the three white people had nothing to do with the crime, but if so, that's a pretty big coincidence. An orange van is a very unique and distinct-looking vehicle, and what's most troubling is that the gas station customer was also certain she caught a glimpse of an automatic weapon in the front seat. One of the men also got incredibly angry about his female companion chatting with the customer, and even went so far as to slap her around, which would lend credence to the idea that they were on their way to commit a crime, and he did not want her attracting attention. Incidentally, the composite sketch they released of the unidentified woman is one of the scariest composite sketches I've ever seen, so if these people had no involvement in Todd's murder, then you have to wonder if they had their own potentially interesting backstory. You'd think the fact that Todd had a housekeeper who had access to his trailer should have propelled Ruthie Mae Anderson to the top of the potential suspects list, so I have to wonder if investigators initially wrote her off because they put so much stock into those three white suspects. It's also interesting how Wilbur Anderson was an employee at Todd's farm, but it's not clear to me if he was one of the laborers who showed up for work on the morning Todd's body was discovered, as I know that all these employees were interrogated and had their footwear checked to see if they matched the footprints at the murder scene, but none of them drew suspicion. And if the Andersons owned or had access to an orange van during that time period, you'd also think that would make them stand out as potential suspects as well. However, according to Jacob Wesley Scott, Ruthie told him that she had two other accomplices on the burglary besides her husband. It's never been established who these accomplices were supposed to be, so perhaps the group from the gas station really were in on it and met up with the Andersons at a later time. So let's look at the evidence against the Andersons. We know they've both served time in jail for other crimes, so they're obviously not saints. One of Todd's missing guns was found in the possession of a man who claimed that Wilbur sold it to him, and Wilbur also allegedly sold an orange van to the owner of a junkyard in Mississippi. Of course, we really only have their word that Wilbur provided them with those items, but what's odd to me is that it seems like there's more evidence to implicate Wilbur than Ruthie, yet she was the one who wound up being charged with Todd's murder. As far as I can tell, the only real evidence against Ruthie was the testimony of a jailhouse informant, Jacob Wesley Scott, who claimed that she confessed to her role in Todd's murder while they were incarcerated together. It sounds like Scott did not get any deals or special treatment from the authorities for coming forward with his story, and they say he only did so because he wanted to help. But the problem is that the testimony of jailhouse informants can be very unreliable, and is something which has led to the conviction of a number of innocent people. Let's face it, these informants are convicted criminals, and while I'm not saying that every single one of them is lying when they share these stories, it also helps to have other corroborating evidence if you're going to use that testimony to prosecute someone. If their testimony is pretty much the crux of the entire case, then that's a huge red flag. And sure enough, when Scott decided to recant his entire story before Ruthie went to trial, the case fell apart. Scott's reasons for doing this are unknown, but without his testimony, they had no choice but to drop the murder charge because there was almost nothing else to implicate Ruthie. I think investigators were hoping they could track down some of Todd's other missing guns and link them to Ruthie, but they never did, so if you'll pardon the pun, they really lacked that smoking gun against her. Now, in spite of my reservations about the case against them, I'm not saying that I believe that Ruthie and Wilbur are innocent. I definitely believe Todd was killed during a botched burglary, and given the circumstances, the Andersons are pretty solid suspects, but there's just not that much evidence against them. And ever since the murder charge against Ruthie was dropped, it seems like the investigation has hit a brick wall. I still wouldn't completely rule out the sighting of the two men and the woman in the orange van, and even if Ruthie and Wilbur were still involved, those people could have been their accomplices. The main reason it's frustrating that the Unsolved Mysteries segment is so hard to find is because this is still an unsolved cold case, and if more people got the opportunity to watch the segment, someone might come forward with a key piece of information. So if you happen to have any information on the unsolved murder of Todd McAfee, please contact the Manatee County Sheriff's Office at 941-747-3011. That's 941-747-3011. So now let's move on and take some time to talk about the Tim Molnar case. In 1984, Tim Molnar was 19 years old and lived in Daytona Beach, Florida with his parents, Michael and Helen Molnar, and was an aeronautical mechanics student at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. On the morning of January the 24th, Tim climbed into his 1969 Dodge Dart and drove his 14-year-old brother Frank to school. After dropping Frank off, Tim briefly returned home in order to pick up his 10-speed bicycle and place it inside his trunk. Tim was scheduled to head to the university to attend class that morning, but as far as anyone can tell, he never showed up, and when he failed to return home that night, his family reported him missing to the police. The following evening, the Molnars received a phone call at their residence, where they could hear nothing but static on the line before the call ended, so they wondered if the caller might have been Tim trying to reach them. 3 weeks later, Tim's parents received a credit card statement, which showed that their card had been used to purchase gas at a service station in Lake City on the same day Tim disappeared. Lake City was located nearly 150 miles northwest of Daytona Beach, but Helen Molnar traveled all the way to the service station to speak with the attendant. When shown Tim's photograph, the attendant seemed to remember him because of his Dodge Dart, and he recalled that Tim was driving alone. Another 4 months passed before the Molnars were surprised to receive a letter from a towing company in Atlanta, Georgia, which stated that Tim's abandoned Dodge Dart was found in a parking lot on January the 30th, 6 days after he originally went missing, and had been in the impound yard ever since. When the Molnars traveled the 430 miles to Atlanta to pick up the car, they discovered that Tim's wallet was still inside. While all of the money had been emptied out, Tim's identification, including his driver's license and credit card, were left behind. Some of the more expensive items that Tim ordinarily kept in the car were missing, such as a tool set and a stereo system he had received for Christmas and personally installed. The 10-speed bicycle Tim placed in his trunk the last time he was seen was also gone. Since the vehicle was abandoned in a parking lot located only a block away from the Greyhound bus terminal, this created speculation that Tim had disappeared voluntarily and hopped on a bus to travel elsewhere and start a new life. Indeed, Shortly before he left, Tim withdrew all but $10 from his savings account, though he left all of his clothes and personal possessions at home. Tim's family could not understand why he would have chosen to run away, as he was known for being very quiet and never causing any trouble. The Molnars would be left without answers for over a decade, until they decided to take the case to Unsolved Mysteries, who featured a segment about Tim's disappearance in November of 1995. In an ironic turn of events, only a few days after Tim went missing, a relative of his passed away and made Tim an heir to their $50,000 estate. If Tim was alive, he would still be entitled to that money, so his family held out hope that Tim might find out about his inheritance by watching the Unsolved Mysteries segment and feel compelled to come forward. Following its original airing, Unsolved Mysteries reran the segment 2 months later on January the 31st, 1996, which would lead to a surprising revelation. After watching the episode, a viewer named Stephen Call called the Unsolved Mysteries Telecenter and shared a story about having come across the skeletal remains of an unidentified male nearly a decade earlier. The discovery took place on March the 23rd, 1986, at a secluded pine plantation in Waukesha County, Wisconsin, near the town of Merton, and the victim's frozen remains had been encased in a sheet of ice. According to Call, even though this location was over 1,200 miles away from Daytona Beach, he started having flashbacks when he watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment about Tim Molnar and heard the description of the clothing Tim had been wearing when he disappeared. Call was certain that the unidentified victim he found was wearing the exact same clothing and wondered if he may have been Tim. Well, this tip would be shared with the Waukesha County Medical Examiner's Office, who had buried the unidentified victim in a local cemetery as a John Doe. When he was found, the victim had a set of rusted keys on him, so the deputy medical examiner contacted the Molnar family and asked them if they still had the same set of locks on their house from the time period Tim went missing. The Molnars had not changed their lock at all, so Helen mailed a copy of her house key to the medical examiner's office, and believe it or not, it wound up matching one of the keys found on the victim. In addition, another key he possessed matched Tim's Dodge Dart. The deputy medical examiner then asked for DNA samples from the Molnars, and sure enough, they wound up matching the John Doe, and he was positively identified as Tim. Tim's body was transported back to Daytona Beach, so his family held a memorial service for him, and were finally able to give him a proper burial. But even though Tim was no longer a missing person, there were a ton of unanswered questions. Tim's exact cause of death could not be determined, and there were no signs of obvious trauma to conclusively establish that foul play had taken place. However, the part which no one could figure out is how Tim traveled all the way from Florida to Wisconsin, and why he went there to begin with. Unfortunately, these questions are still unanswered, and the exact circumstances of Tim Molnar's death remain a perplexing mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So if you know this podcast well, you're probably aware that I am particularly fascinated by cases in which a victim goes missing or is found deceased at a location which is a great distance away from where they live, and they had no reason to travel there in the first place. Well, Tim Molnar's case is definitely one of the most bizarre examples of that. If I could, I would devote an entire episode to this story, but unfortunately, the information I just shared with you is pretty much all that's available. The Unsolved Mysteries segment was less than 5 minutes long, but even though Tim had been missing for over a decade by that point, you can understand why they elected to air it. Unlike many of the other missing persons cases they profiled, there was a decent chance that Tim had disappeared voluntarily and was still alive out there somewhere. The reason the segment put so much emphasis on the $50,000 inheritance Tim was entitled to receive was because there was hope he might feel compelled to resurface and contact his family if he knew he had a lot of money coming his way. But instead, this led to one of the most astonishing viewer tips in the show's history. I mean, if a guy phones in and says he believes that Tim might be an unidentified skeleton found on the opposite end of the country one decade earlier because they happen to be wearing the same clothing, there's a good reason to be skeptical. Yet remarkably, this tip wound up panning out. I still can't believe Stephen Cull remembered the clothes the victim was wearing, but I guess finding a skeleton is such a vivid experience that details like that will stick with you. Since Tim's remains were found in Wisconsin over 1,200 miles away from his home, this did lend credence to the idea that he took off on his own in order to start a new life. I know his family has always maintained that they could not understand why Tim would do this, but either they're withholding key information, or there was just something going on inside Tim's head which they did not know about. They described him as a quiet, sensitive individual, so there may have been something that just made him feel like he needed to get away from everything. There is a lot to suggest that Tim was planning a getaway, as he emptied out most of the money from his bank account, left his identification behind in his car, and possibly sold off some valuable items, such as his car stereo, tool set, and bicycle, to help finance his getaway. Since the car was abandoned near a Greyhound terminal in Atlanta, it's reasonable to assume that Tim drove there of his own volition before hopping on a bus which took him all the way to Wisconsin. But that still doesn't shed any light on how he ultimately wound up dead. Tim's skeletal remains were not found until March of 1986, over 2 years after he went missing, but there's no way to determine how long he had been dead by that point. Since he was apparently found in the same clothing he was wearing at the time he vanished, this suggests that Tim died a short time after leaving Daytona Beach, especially when you consider that he didn't take any other clothing with him. But of course, even though Tim's remains were found encased in a sheet of ice, they obviously would not have been frozen that way during the summers of 1984 and 1985. So this means that either Tim's remains went undiscovered that entire time, which is certainly possible, since it sounds like this was a pretty remote location, or he was actually still alive for a while after he abandoned his car in Atlanta. Remember, the idea that Tim traveled on a bus from Atlanta to Wisconsin is just an assumption. For all we know, he could have traveled elsewhere and went to Wisconsin at a later time. I still wonder if Stephen Cull was accurate when he claimed the skeleton had on the exact same clothes Tim was wearing on the day he disappeared. He may have misremembered things a bit, but it was just pure happenstance that his hunch paid off and the victim turned out to be Tim. However, Tim did leave the rest of his clothing behind at home, so perhaps he never bothered to bring a change of clothes along with him because he was planning to end his life. While it might seem weird that someone would travel over 1,200 miles to the opposite end of the country to stage an elaborate suicide, this sort of thing is not unprecedented. One of the most memorable cases ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries was the disappearance of Gail Delano, who vanished after her abandoned car was found outside a restaurant in Brunswick, Maine, but it would later turn out that she traveled over 1,500 miles to Mobile, Alabama, in order to check into a hotel room under a fake name before she took her own life via an overdose. It seems obvious that Gail attempted to arrange things so that her family would never find out what happened to her, and while her actions may not make logical sense, you can never truly know what's going on inside the head of a suicidal person. In Tim's case, it's possible he may have done the exact same thing, and that he only drained his bank account and sold off some items so that he would have just enough money to travel to another state and end his life in a remote area. That might explain why after dropping his brother off at school on the morning he disappeared, Tim took a special trip back home to put his bicycle into his trunk, because he may have realized that he could make additional cash by selling it. If Tim was legitimately planning to go somewhere and start a new life, it is odd that he didn't also attempt to sell his car as well, instead of just abandoning it, since that would have given him even more money to pull this off. There are definitely a lot of weird contradictions here, as leaving his identification behind suggests that Tim had no intention of ever coming back, yet he still had his house and car keys in his possession when his remains were found. Of course, the key difference between Tim's disappearance and the Gail Delano case is that Gail had a very well-documented history of clinical depression, whereas we really don't know anything about Tim's mental state at the time he disappeared. If Tim was legitimately traveling elsewhere to start a new life, he could have gotten in way over his head and died of exposure, as we are talking about a Florida resident attempting to navigate rural Wisconsin in the middle of January. But it's also possible that Jim crossed paths with the wrong person on the trip, who subsequently murdered him. The location Tim's remains were found was about a half hour's drive outside Milwaukee, so hypothetically, if Tim got on a bus in Atlanta and traveled to Milwaukee, he could have hitched a ride with someone who did him harm and dumped his body in a remote area. Since there were no obvious signs of trauma on Tim's remains and his exact cause of death could not be determined, there really isn't any evidence which points to one particular theory about how he died. However, I do have to make mention of a very interesting post which popped up on a subreddit about unsolved mysteries cases last year. The poster, who went by the username Tim Molnar's Revenge, claims they have family in Wisconsin who have pointed suspicion towards a former acquaintance of their uncle. I won't repeat the suspect's name here, but he has spent time in prison for second-degree sexual assault against a child, and according to the poster, he lived near the area where Tim's remains were found, and often let young male drifters crash there. This man would also spend his winters in Florida, and had his own plane, and given that Tim was studying to be an aeronautical mechanic, could the suspects have crossed paths with Tim in Florida in January of 1984, and somehow convinced him to travel to Wisconsin, where he was subsequently murdered? Well, this whole scenario is nothing more than pure speculation, and it doesn't account for some of the stranger details in this case, such as Tim's abandoned car being found in Atlanta, but the poster said they did share this tip with law enforcement, so we'll see if anything comes out of it. I certainly don't rule out the possibility that Tim crossed paths with this guy, but part of me leans towards the idea that Tim made the trip to Wisconsin of his own volition for reasons we'll never understand, because something was going on in his mind at that time. So while Tim could have been the victim of foul play, if his death was the result of suicide, an accident, or simply dying of exposure, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. After over a decade of not knowing what happened to him, at least the Molnar family were able to bring Tim home and give him a proper burial, though I can't imagine how frustrating it still must have been for them to have no answers about what Tim was doing in Wisconsin or how he died. So if you happen to have any additional information on what happened to Tim Molnar, please do what that aforementioned Reddit poster did and contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about either of these cases I've covered today, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I decided to do a more lighthearted episode about my top 10 unsolved mysteries guilty pleasures, where I discuss some of the silliest segments the show has ever produced, which still managed to be very entertaining. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Sana K, Kim L, Sarah R, and Sarah K. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I would like to play a promo for another podcast about unsolved mysteries, still unknown.
Hello, Trail Went Cold listeners. My name is Joe Schwartz, and I want to tell you about a podcast that I host called Still Unknown, an unsolved true crime podcast. Like Robin, I too grew up on unsolved mysteries, and it led to a lifelong fascination with true crime, in particular unsolved cases. Every other Monday, I talk about a different unsolved murder, disappearance, or unexplained death, in hopes that telling these stories will someday bring out the answers that these cases are desperately seeking. You can listen to my podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to The Trail Went Cold. You can follow me on Instagram at Still Unknown Podcast, on Twitter at Still Unknown Pod. And who knows, you may even be able to help reveal the final pieces to help solve a case. So subscribe now to hear a new case every other Monday, and let's try to solve some mysteries together.
Anyway, since we covered two Florida cases today, I guess now would be an appropriate time to remind you that on the weekend of May 1st to the 3rd, I will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held at the World Center Marriott Hotel in Orlando. This will mark my fourth consecutive year attending the event, and if you would like to purchase tickets and haven't already done so, you can get a 10% discount by visiting crimecon.com and using the promo code COLD20. That's COLD20. And for the second consecutive year, I will also be attending the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Lowe's Hotel in Kansas City, Missouri, on the weekend of July the 11th to the 12th. If you would like to purchase tickets to that event and haven't already done so, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com and earn yourself a 10% discount by using the promo code TTWC. That's TTWC. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. And yes, those two will be joining me at CrimeCon this year, so if you attend the event, you'll get to meet them as well. Anyway, if you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a great week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.